I said, doing my best Elvis imitation. I'll be here all week. Rachel didn't look at me. I mean, if nothing else, the fact that I rhymed Minnesota. No, that was impressive, she agreed, her eyes closed. All right then, ladies. If you'll excuse me, I'm going to pretend that this whole thing went well, and I'm going to leave while I'm ahead on points. I walked slowly enough for her to have caught up with me, if she wanted. Chapter 17. I snap out of my reverie and slide into the parking space, just where I was told it would be, not 3 miles from the White House. I park the car until the ignition. No one else is in sight. I grab my bag and get out. The back entrance looks like a loading dock of some sort with steps up to a large door that has no outside knob. A voice through an intercom squawks at me. Who is it, please? Charles Kane, I say. A moment later, the thick door pops ajar. I reach in and pull it open. Inside is a freight area, empty of people, cluttered with UPS and FedEx boxes, large crates, and wheeled dollies. A large elevator is to the right, the doors open, the walls covered with thick padding. I press the top button and the doors close. I draw a sharp breath as the elevator reacts clumsily, dropping for a moment before lifting me, the grinding of the gears audible. Another moment of lightheadedness. I put my hand against the padded wall and wait it out, while Dr. Lane's words echo in my head. When I reach the top and the doors open, I step out carefully into a well-appointed hallway, the walls painted a light yellow. Monet Prince guiding me toward the only door on the top floor, the penthouse. When I reach the door, it opens without my doing anything. Charles Kane at your service, I say. Amanda Braidwood stands inside the penthouse, her arm fully extended as she holds the door open and appraises me. A thin sweater hangs loose over a fitted shirt. She's wearing black stretch pants and nothing on her feet. Her hair is long these days, courtesy of the movie she wrapped a month ago. But tonight, it's pulled back into a ponytail, with a few strands hanging down to frame the contours of her face. "Well, hello there, Mr. Kane," she says. "Sorry about the subterfuge, but the doorman at the front entrance is a little busybody-ish." Last year, an entertainment magazine named Mandy one of the 20 most beautiful women on the planet. Another dubbed her one of the top 20 highest-paid actors in Hollywood, less than a year after she took home her second Oscar. She and Rachel lived together all 4 years at Harvard and stayed in touch over the years, as closely as a North Carolina lawyer and an international movie star can manage. The code name Charles Kane was Mandy's idea. About 8 years ago, over a bottle of wine in the backyard of the governor's mansion, Rachel, Mandy, and I agreed that Orson Welles' masterpiece was the finest movie ever made. She shakes her head as a smile slowly blooms on her face. "My, my," she says. "Whiskers, scruff," she adds as she kisses my cheek. "How rugged." "Well, don't just stand there looking all outdoorsy. Come in." Her scent, the smell of a woman, lingers with me. Rachel wasn't much for perfume, but her bath gel and body lotion, whatever you call all those creams and lotions and soaps, were both vanilla. I will never smell that scent again as long as I live, without seeing the image of Rachel's bare shoulder and imagining the softness of her neck. They say there's no manual for overcoming the death of a spouse. That's truer still when the survivor is the president and all hell is breaking loose, because you have no time to grieve. There are too many decisions to make that won't wait. Constant security threats that, with even a momentary lapse in your attention, can have catastrophic consequences. As Rachel hit the end stages of her illness, we watched North Korea and Russia and China more closely than ever, knowing that the leaders of those countries were looking for any hint of vulnerability or inattention from the White House. I considered temporarily stepping down as president. I even had Danny drop the papers, but Rachel would have none of it. She was determined that her illness would not cause any interruption in my presidency. It mattered to her in an intense way that she never fully explained, and I never fully understood. 3 days before Rachel passed, by that point, we'd returned to Raleigh so she could die at home. North Korea tested an intercontinental ballistic missile off its coast, and I ordered an aircraft carrier into the Yellow Sea. The day we buried her, as I stood at her grave, holding hands with my daughter, our embassy in Venezuela was attacked by a suicide bomber, and I soon found myself in our kitchen with generals and our national security team considering options for a proportional response. In the short term, it's probably easier to deal with personal loss when the world around you constantly demands your attention. You're too busy to be sad and lonely at first. Then the reality drops in. You've lost the love of your life. Your daughter has lost her mother. And a wonderful woman was denied the chance to live a long, rich life. Now you're grateful for the demands of your job. But there are moments of intense loneliness, even when you're the president. I'd never felt it before. I had plenty of tough decisions to make in my first 2 years, plenty of times I could do nothing more than pray that I'd made the right call. Times when it didn't matter how many aides I had because the buck stopped with me and me alone. But I never felt alone. I always had Rachel there with me, giving me her honest opinion about how I was making the decisions, telling me to do the best I could, then wrapping her arms around my neck when it was over. I still miss Rachel all the time, in every way a man can miss his wife. Tonight I miss her uncanny sense of when to dress me down and when to back me up, make me believe that no matter what, everything will turn out all right. There will never be another Rachel, I know that. But I do wish I weren't alone all the time. Rachel demanded that we talk about what would happen after she died. She used to joke that I'd be the most eligible bachelor on the planet. Maybe. Right now, I feel like a clueless nerd about to let everybody down.
Drink? Mandy asks over her shoulder.
No time, I say. I don't have very long. Honestly, I don't even understand why you want to do this, she says. But I'm ready. Let's get to it. I follow her into the apartment. Chapter 18. This feels weird, I say.
You're doing fine, Mandy whispers. Nobody's ever done this to you?
No, and I hope nobody ever does again. It will be more enjoyable for both of us, she says, if you'd stop complaining. For God's sake, John, you were tortured in a Baghdad prison and you can't handle this. You do this every day?
Most days. Now hold still. It's easier that way.
Easier for her, maybe. I try to stay still as possible, seated in a pink chair in the dressing room inside Mandy's bedroom suite, as she uses a makeup pencil on my eyebrows. To my right, Mandy's vanity is covered with makeup supplies, bottles and brushes and powders and creams and clays of all different sizes and colors. It looks like something on the set of a B-movie about vampires or zombies. Don't make me look like Groucho Marx, I say.
No, no, she says. But speaking of,
she reaches down and pulls something out of a bag and shows it to me. Groucho Marx sunglasses, the bushy eyebrows and mustache. I take them from her. Rachel's, I say. When Rachel started getting really sick, it bothered her how sorry for her everyone felt. So when friends would come to visit, she had a little routine to lighten things up. I'd warn people that Rachel isn't really herself today, and when they'd walk into the room, they'd see Rachel in bed wearing the Groucho glasses. Sometimes it was a clown nose. She had a mask of Richard Nixon, too, which really got a laugh. That was Rachel, right there, always worrying about everyone but herself.
Anyway, says Mandy before things get too misty, Don't worry about your eyebrows. I'm just thickening them a little. You'd be amazed how they can change one's appearance. Eyes and eyebrows. She scoots back in her chair and looks at me. Honestly, kiddo, that beard you showed up with was half the battle right there. And it's so red, it almost doesn't look real. You want me to color your hair to match? Definitely not. She shakes her head, still studying my face like it's a lab specimen. Your hair isn't long enough to do much with, she mumbles, talking to herself more than to me. Changing the part from the right to the left wouldn't help. We could forget the part and comb it all forward. She puts her hands in my hair, gripping it, finger-combing it, mussing it. At least you have a hairstyle that matches this decade. How about I wear a baseball cap, I say. Oh, she draws back. Sure, that would be easier. Does that work? Did you bring one? Yeah. I reach down into my bag and pull out a Nationals baseball cap. Put it on. Reliving your glory days, eh? Okay, well, between the beard and the red baseball cap, the eyebrows and, her head bobs back and forth. The key is in the eyes, she says, gesturing to her own face. She lets out a sigh. Your eyes haven't looked the same, honey. What do you mean? Since Rachel, she says. Your eyes haven't looked the same since she died. She snaps out of it. Sorry. Let's get you in some eyeglasses. You don't wear glasses, do you? Reading glasses when I'm tired. I say, hang on. She goes to her closet and comes out with a rectangular velvet box. She pops it open and reveals about 50 pairs of eyeglasses, each perched in a small divot. Geez, Mandy. I borrowed these from Jamie, she says, when we did the sequel to London last year. It's coming out this Christmas. Heard about that. Congrats. Yeah, well, I told Stephen that was the last one I'm doing. Rodney couldn't keep his paws off me the whole time, but I handled it. She hands me a pair of eyeglasses with thick brown frames. I put them on. Humph, she says. No, try these. I try another pair. No, these. I'm not trying to win a fashion award, I say. She gives me a deadpan look. You're in absolutely no danger of that, my sweet, believe me. Here. She removes another pair. These. These, yes. She hands me a pair with thick frames again, but this time the color is more of a reddish-brown. I put them on, and she lights up. It blends in with your beard, she says. I make a face. No, I mean it throws off your color completely, John. You're fair, dirty blonde, and fair-complected. The glasses and beard highlight a deep brown-red. I stand up and go to the mirror over her vanity. You've lost weight, she says. You were never overweight a day in your life, but you're looking skinny. I'm not hearing a compliment in there. I check myself out in the mirror. I'm still myself, but I see her point about the change in my coloring. The cap, the glasses, and the beard, and I never realized how much slightly thicker eyebrows could change the look of a person. All that, and no Secret Service entourage. Nobody will recognize me. You know, John. It's okay to move on with your life. You're only 50. She wanted you to. In fact, she made me She stops on that, some color coming to her face, a sheen over her eyes. You and Rachel talked about that? She nods, placing a hand on her chest, taking a moment to let the emotion dissipate. She said to me, and I quote, "Don't let John spend the rest of his life alone out of some misplaced sense of loyalty." I take a sharp breath. Those words, some misplaced sense of loyalty, were exactly what she said to me more than once. They bring Rachel right back into the room, as if her breath is on my face, her head angled as it always was when she had something important to say. Her vanilla scent, the dimple in her right cheek, the smile lines by her eyes. Her hand clutching mine. That last day, her voice groggy from the pain meds, so weak, but strong enough to squeeze my hand tight one last time. Promise me you'll meet someone else, Jonathan. Promise me. My only point, Mandy says, her voice gravelly with emotion, is that everyone understands that there's a time when you have to get back in the ring. You shouldn't have to disguise your appearance just to go on a date.
I take a moment of my own to recover and to remember something I never should have forgotten, that Mandy has no idea what's happening. Sure, now that I think about it, it makes sense that she'd think I was meeting a woman for a date, dinner or a drink or a movie, and I might not want our first get-together observed by the international press. You are going on a date, aren't you? Her perfectly shaped eyebrows come together as she starts thinking things through. If I'm not going on a date, then what am I doing? Why else would a president sneak away from his security detail and travel incognito? Before I let that imaginative mind of hers go any further down the path, I say, I'm meeting someone. Yes. She waits for more and is hurt when it isn't forthcoming. But she's handled me with kid gloves since Rachel's death, and she won't push if I don't want to be pushed. I clear my throat as I check my watch. I'm on a strict schedule. I'm not used to that. I always have a busy schedule. But the president is never late. Everybody waits for him. Not this time. I have to go now, I tell her. Chapter 19. I take the freight elevator back down and come out into the alley. My car is still parked in its spot. I drive to the Capitol Hill neighborhood and find a parking lot near 7th Street and North Carolina, leaving my keys with an attendant who hardly glances at my face. I blend in with the pedestrians and the sounds of people enjoying a spring Friday evening in a vibrant residential neighborhood. Restaurants and bars with their windows flung open, people laughing and mingling, pop music blasting from speakers. I come upon a shabbily dressed man sitting against the wall of a corner coffee shop. A German shepherd lying next to him, pants in the heat next to an empty bowl. The man, like many of the homeless, is wearing more layers than he needs. He also wears dark, scratched-up sunglasses. The sign he's been holding says Homeless Veteran, but it now leans against the wall of the building. It must be break time. On his other side, a small cardboard box holds a few dollar bills. Music is playing quietly on a boombox. I remove myself from the wave of pedestrian traffic and bend down next to him. I recognize the song playing, Van Morrison's Into the Mystic. My mind whirls back to a slow dance in Savannah during basic training, closing time at one of the bars on River Street, my brain foggy from booze, my limbs aching from smoke sessions and training exercises. "Are you a Gulf vet, sir?" I ask. By his appearance, I'd almost guessed Vietnam before factoring in the lean years, which likely aged him faster than they should have. "Sure am," he says. "But I wasn't no sir. I earned my pay, friend. Platoon sergeant in the Big Red Want. I was there when they breached Saddam's wire." I sense the pride well up in him. It feels good to give him that moment. I want to throw another log onto that fire. Get this guy a sandwich. Listen just a little more. But I also feel the press of time and check my watch. "First Infantry Division, huh? You guys led the charge into Iraq, right?"
"Tip of the spear, man. We rolled over those Republican Guard pansies like they were caught sleeping."
"Not bad for a leg," I say.
"A leg?"
He sounds surprised.
"You served? What were you, airborne?"
"I'm a hooah, just like you," I say. "Yeah, I spent a couple of years in the 75th. He sits up a little and raises his ungroomed unibrow.
"Airborne Ranger, huh? I bet you saw some shit, boy. Raids and recon missions, right?"
"Not as much as you guys in the bigger units," I say, deflecting the narrative back to him. "What did it take you guys, a week to get halfway up the country?"
"And then we stopped short," he says with a crimped mouth. "I always thought that was a mistake."
"Hey," I say, "I could use a sandwich. How about you?"
"That would be much appreciated," he says.
As I move toward the door, he adds,
"This place makes a killer turkey sandwich, by the way."
Turkey it is. When I return, I'm committed to a quick exit, but not without finding out a few more things. "What's your name, Hua?" I ask.
"Sergeant First Class Christopher Knight," he says.
"Here you go, Sergeant." I hand him the paper sack of food. I put down the dish full of water for the dog, who laps it up until it's gone. "It's been an honor to meet you, Sergeant.
Where do you put your head down at night?
Shelter's a couple of streets over. I come here most mornings. People are a little nicer.
I have to move along, but here, Chris, take this. I pull the change from the meal out of my pocket and give it to him.
God bless you, he says,
squeezing my hand with the still, firm grip of a warrior. For some reason, that starts a catch in my throat. I've visited clinics and hospitals and done my best to reform the Department of Veterans Affairs, but this is what I don't see. The homeless PTSD vet who can't find or hold down a job. I move back along the sidewalk, taking out my cell phone to store his name and the coffee shop location so I can make sure this guy gets some help before it's too late for him. But there are tens of thousands like him. The familiar feeling passes through me, the sense that my ability to help people is both vast and limited at the same time. You'll learn to live with a paradox. If you don't, obsessing over the limits will keep you from making the most of what you can do. Meanwhile, you keep looking for chances to push the limits back, to do as much as you can do for as many as you can every day. Even on the bad days, there's always something good you can do. Two blocks beyond Sergeant Knight, as I walk among the shadows created by the setting sun, the crowd ahead of me has stopped moving. I walk through some people and step into the street to get a better look. Two police officers from D.C. Metro are trying to force a man to the ground, an African-American kid in a white T-shirt and jeans. He is resisting, trying to swing his arms free while one of the two officers tries to cuff him. They have weapons and tasers but aren't using them, at least not yet. Two or three people along the sidewalk are holding up their phones and filming the incident.
Get on the ground! On the ground! The officers are shouting.
The man they're trying to take into custody stumbles to his right, the officers along with him, spilling over into the street where traffic is stopped, blocked by the police car. I take a step forward instinctively, then step back. What am I going to do? Announce that I'm the president and I'll handle this? There's nothing for me to do but either gawk or leave. I have no idea what led up to this moment. It could be that this man has committed a violent felony or even a purse snatching, or maybe he just pissed these guys off. I hope the officers are simply responding to a call and acting properly. I know that most cops, most of the time, do the best they can. I know that there are bad cops, just as there are bad actors in every profession. And I know that there are cops who think of themselves as good cops, but even if unconsciously, see a black man in a T-shirt and jeans as more threatening than a white man dressed the same way. I look around at the watching crowd, people of all races and colors. 10 different people could watch the same thing and come away with 10 unique takes on it. Some will see good cops doing their job. Some will see a black person being treated differently because of the color of his skin. Sometimes it's the one, sometimes it's the other. Sometimes it's a bit of both. Regardless, in the back of every onlooker's mind is the same question. Will this unarmed man leave the scene unshot? A second squad car rolls down the street as the officers get the man to the ground, cuff him, and lift him to his feet. I cross the street and head to my next destination. There are no easy solutions to problems like these, so I try to follow my own advice, understand my limitations, and keep doing whatever I can to make things better. An executive order, a bill that reaches my desk, speeches, words from my bully pulpit. These things can set the right tone, move us in the right direction. But it's a battle as old as humanity. Us versus them. In every age and time, individuals, families, clans, and nations have struggled with how to treat the other. In America, racism is our oldest curse. But there are other divides. Over religion, immigration, sexual identity. Sometimes the them strategy is just a narcotic to feed the beast in all of us. All too often, those who rail against them prevail over earnest pleas to remember what we can be and do together. Our brains have worked this way for a long time. Maybe they always will, but we have to keep trying. That's the permanent mission. Our founding fathers left us, moving toward the more perfect union. The wind whips up as I turn a corner. I look up at a troubled sky, ash-colored clouds.
As I walk to the end of the street toward the bar on the corner, I fear I'm facing the hardest part of a very tough night. Chapter 20. I take a deep breath and enter the bar. Inside, banners for the Georgetown Hoyas and Skins and Nationals, televisions perched in the corners of the exposed brick walls, loud music competing with the animated chatter of the happy hour crowd. Many are dressed casually, college and grad students, but some are young, after-work professionals, in their suits, with ties pulled loose or in blouses and pants. The outdoor patio is filled to the brim. The floors are sticky, and the odor is one of stale beer. I'm taken back again to Savannah during basic training, when we used to tear up River Street on the weekends. A nod to the two Secret Service agents dressed in suits, standing sentry. They've been told that I was coming and how I'd be dressed. They've been told not to formally acknowledge me, and they follow that directive, only brief nods, a slight stiffening of their posture. In the back quarter, my daughter is seated at a table surrounded by people, some friends, some who just want to be in the presence of the first daughter, drinking something colorful and fruity from a glass, as another woman whispers something into her ear over the loud music. She reacts to the comment, bringing her hand to her mouth, as if trying to laugh and swallow at the same time, but it looks forced. She's just being polite. Her eyes scan the room. They pass over me at first, but then return to me. Lily's lips part, her eyes narrow. Finally, her expression softens. It took her a moment, so my disguise must be pretty good. I keep walking, past the bathrooms, into the stockroom at the back of the bar. The door unlocked by design. Inside, it smells like a frat house, with shelves upon shelves of assorted liquors, kegs lined up along the walls, open boxes of napkins and bar glasses on the concrete floor. My heart swells when she walks in, the infant with a round face and enormous eyes reaching out to touch my face, the little girl lifting herself up on her tippy toes to kiss me with a PBJ smudge face. The teenager slicing the air with her hand as she argued the merits of alternative energy incentives at the state debate finals. When she draws back and looks me in the eyes, her smile has vanished. So this is real. It's real. Did she come to the White House? She did, yeah. I can't say more than that. Where are you going? She asks. What are you doing? Why don't you have Secret Service? Why are you dressed in some disguise? Hey. I hold her at the shoulders. It's okay, Lil. I'm going to meet with them. With Nina and her partner? I highly doubt that the girl in the Princeton t-shirt gave my daughter her real name. But the less said, the better. Yes, I say. I haven't seen her since she talked to me, says Lily. Not once. She completely disappeared from the program. I don't think she was ever enrolled in the Sorbonne program, I say. I think she went to Paris to see you. To deliver the message. But why talk to me, of all people? I don't answer. I don't want to give any more specifics than necessary. But Lily has her mother's smarts. It doesn't take her long. She knew that I'd deliver the message to you directly, she says. No intermediaries, no filter. That's exactly why. So what did she mean, Lily asks. What's dark ages? Lil. I draw her in close, but don't say anything. You won't tell me. You can't, she adds, giving me the out, forgiving me. It must be important. So important that you asked me to fly home from Paris, and now you're doing whatever it is you're doing. She glances over her shoulder. Where's Alex? Where's your protection? Other than Frick and Frack, the men you sent to guard me. Since she graduated from college, Lily has opted to decline protection, as is her right. But the moment I got the call from her last Monday, I rushed the service to her side. It took a couple of days to get her home, because she had a final exam, and I was assured she was secure in Paris. My protection is around, I say. She doesn't need to know that I'm going it alone. She has enough anxiety as it is. Getting over the loss of her mother, barely a year ago, it's still a work in progress. She doesn't need to add the possibility of losing a second parent. She's no child. And mature beyond her years. But she's only 23, for God's sake. Still a babe in the woods when it comes to what life will throw at her. My chest tightens at the thought of what this could mean to Lily. But I had no choice. I made a vow to defend this country, and I'm the only person who can do this. Listen, I say, taking her hand. I want you to spend the next few days at the White House. Your room's all ready. If you need anything from your condo, the agents will get it for you. I don't understand. She turns and looks at me, her lips trembling slightly. Are you in danger, Daddy? It's all I can do to rein in my emotions. She stopped calling me Daddy during adolescence, though she pulled it out once or twice when Rachel was dying. She reserves it for the times when she's feeling most vulnerable, most terrified. I have stood down sadistic drill sergeants, cruel Iraqi interrogators, partisan lawmakers, and the Washington press corps, but my daughter can punch my buttons like no one else. I lean over and touch my head against hers.
Me?
Come on. I'm just being cautious. I just want to know that you're safe. It's not enough for her. She wraps her arms around my neck and squeezes tight. I draw her close, too. I can hear her sobs, feel her body shake. I'm so proud of you, Lily, I whisper, trying to avoid catching my throat.
I ever tell you that?
You tell me that all the time, she says into my ear. I stroke the hair of my brilliant, strong, independent girl. She is a woman now, with her mother's beauty and brains and spirit. But she will always be the little girl who lit up when she saw me, who squealed when I'd bombard her with kisses, who couldn't fall back asleep after a nightmare unless Daddy held her hand. Go with the agents now, I whisper, will you? She pulls back from me, wipes the tears off her cheeks, takes a breath, looks at me with hopeful eyes, and nods. Then she lunges toward me, throwing her arms around me again. I squeeze my eyes shut, holding a trembling body. Suddenly, my grown daughter is 15 years younger, a grade schooler who needs her daddy, a father who is supposed to be her rock, who will never let her down. I wish I could hold her, wipe away her tears, allay her every concern. I had to teach myself long ago that I couldn't follow my baby girl around and make sure the world was kind to her. And now I have to pry myself loose and get on with the business at hand when I'd like nothing more than to hold her and never let go. I cup my hands around her face, my daughter's hopeful, swollen eyes looking up at me. I love you more than anything in the world, I say. And I promise I will come back to you. Chapter 21. After Lily leaves the bar with the Secret Service agents, I ask the bartender for a glass of water. I reach into my pocket and take out my pills, the steroids that will boost my platelet count. I hate these pills. They mess up my head. But I either operate with a fuzzy brain or I'm out of commission altogether. There's no in-between. And the latter is not an option. I walk back to my car. The clouds are as bruised as the backs of my legs. No rain has fallen, but the smell of it is in the air. I pull my phone out of my pocket and call Dr. Lane as I walk. She won't recognize this number, but she answers anyway. Dr. Lane, it's John Duncan. Mr. President, I've been trying to reach you all afternoon. I know, I've been busy. Your count is continuing to drop. You're under 16,000. Okay, I'm doubling up on the steroids like I promised. It's not enough. You need immediate treatment. I almost walk into oncoming traffic, not paying attention as I step into a crosswalk. An SUV driver lays on the horn in case I hadn't noticed my mistake. I'm not at 10,000 yet, I say to Dr. Lane. That's a guideline. Everyone is different. You could be suffering internal bleeding as we speak. But that's unlikely, I say. The MRI was negative yesterday. Yesterday, yes. Today, who knows? I reach the lot where my car is parked. I hand over my ticket and cash, and the attendant hands me the keys. Mr. President, you're surrounded by talented and capable people. I'm sure they could keep on top of things for a few hours while you take a treatment. I thought presidents delegated. They do, most of the time. But this I can't delegate, and I can't tell her or anyone else why. I hear everything you're saying, Deborah. I have to go now. Keep your phone handy. I punch out the phone, start up the car, and drive through thick traffic, thinking about the girl in the Princeton t-shirt, Nina, to my daughter. Thinking about dark ages. Thinking about my next meeting tonight, threats I can issue, offers I can make. A man holding a white sign that says parking waves me into a lot. I pay money and follow another man's directions to a spot. I keep my keys and walk for 2 blocks until I stop in front of a medium-rise apartment building bearing the name Camden South Capitol over the entrance. Across the street, there is a roar from the crowd. I cross the boulevard, no easy task with the traffic. A man passes me saying, "Who needs to? Who needs to?" I remove the envelope Nina gave me and pull out the single colorful ticket to tonight's game, the Nationals versus the Mets. At the left field gate of Nationals Park, attendants are processing people through a metal detector, wanding people who don't pass the test, checking bags for weapons. I wait my place in line, but it's a short wait. The game has already started. My seat is in section 104, nosebleed seats. I'm accustomed to the best seats in the house, a skybox behind home plate or right off the dugout on the third baseline. But I like this better. Here in the left field stands, my view isn't the greatest, but it feels more real. I look around, but there's no point. It'll happen when it happens. My job is to sit here and wait. Ordinarily, I'd be like a kid in a candy store here. I'd grab a Budweiser and a hot dog. You can shelve all those microbrews at a ball game. There is no finer beverage than an ice-cold Bud. And no food ever tasted so good as a dog with mustard at a ball game. Not even my mama's rib tips with vinegar sauce. I'd kick back and remember those days hurling fastballs at UNC. Dreams of a pro career when the Royals drafted me in the 4th round. My year in Double A with the Memphis Chicks. Sweating on buses, icing my elbow at night in dive motels, playing before crowds numbering only in the hundreds, eating Big Macs and dipping Copenhagen. But no beer from me tonight. My stomach is already in turmoil as I wait for my visitor, the Princeton girl's partner. My phone vibrates in the pocket of my jeans. The caller ID on the screen reads C. Brock. Carolyn texts a single number, 3. I type back, "Well, man," and hit send. This is our code for a status update. So far, so good. But I'm not sure everything is so good so far. I'm late to the ball game. Did he already come and go? Did I miss him? That couldn't be. But there's nothing I can do but sit here and wait and watch the game. The Mets pitcher has a live arm but overthrows his split-fingered fastball, which is why it won't drop. The Nationals' leadoff hitter, a lefty, is in an obvious bunt situation with men on first and second and the third baseman staying back. The pitcher should throw high and inside, but he doesn't. He gets lucky when the batter can't get the bunt down either time he tries. Ofttimately, with 2 strikes, the kid lofts a long fly ball to deep left field toward me. Instinctively, the crowd rises, but he got under it too much, and the Mets left fielder hauls it in short of the warning track. When we all sit back down, someone in my peripheral vision is still standing, angling down the road toward me. He's wearing a Nationals cap that looks brand new, but otherwise he looks completely out of place at a baseball game. I know instantly that the seat he's going to take is the open one next to mine. The man is Nina's partner. It's time.
Chapter 22. The assassin known as Bach closes the door, locking herself in the small bathroom. She draws a shaky breath, drops to her knees, and vomits into the toilet. When she's done, her eyes stinging, her stomach knotted up, she takes a breath and falls back on her haunches. This is no good. Unacceptable. When she's able to, she stands up, flushes the toilet, and uses Clorox wipes to thoroughly scrub the toilet, then flushes the wipes, too. No trace evidence. No DNA. That is the last time she will vomit tonight. Period. She checks herself in the dingy mirror above the sink. Her wig is blonde, a bun. Her uniform is sky blue. Not optimal, but she didn't get to pick the outfits worn by the cleaning crew at the Camden South Capitol Apartments. When she emerges from the bathroom into the maintenance room, the three men are still standing there, likewise dressed in light blue shirts and dark trousers. One of the men is so muscular that his biceps and chest nearly bulge out of his shirt. She took an instant dislike to him when she met him earlier today. First, because he stands out. Nobody in their profession should stand out. And second, because he has probably relied too often on his brute strength and not enough on wits and skill and a nasty temperament. The other two are acceptable. Wiry and solid, but not physically impressive. Homely, forgettable faces.
"Feeling better?"
the muscle-bound guy says. The other two react with a smile until they see the look on Bach's face. "Better than you're going to feel," she says, "if you ask me that again." Don't mess with a woman in her first trimester of pregnancy with morning sickness that isn't limited, apparently, to the morning. Especially one who specializes in high-risk assassinations. She turns to the leader of the trio, a bald man with a glass eye. He raises his hands in apology.
"No disrespect, no disrespect," he says.
His English is good, though heavily accented. The Czech Republic, if she's guessing. She puts out her hand. The leader hands her an earbud. She fits it in her ear, and the man does the same. "Status?" she asks. Through her earbud comes the answer.
"He has arrived. Our team is ready."
"Then we will all take our positions," she says.
With her weapon case and duffel bag in tow, Bach takes the freight elevator. While inside, she removes a black coat from her bag and puts it on. She removes her wig for the time being and puts on a black ski cap. She is now dressed from head to toe in black. She gets off the elevator at the top and climbs the stairs to the door to the roof. As promised, it is unlocked. The wind on the roof is swirling, but it's nothing for which she can't adjust. She feels certain it will rain at some point, but at least it has held off until now. Had this silly sporting event been canceled altogether, her operation would have been aborted. So now she must be prepared for the rain interrupting this sports contest, forcing thousands of people out at once, hidden amid a sea of umbrellas. She once killed a Turkish ambassador by firing a bullet through an umbrella into his brain, but he was with only one other person on a quiet street. Her problem tonight will be acquiring her target in the first scenario, should a mass of people move simultaneously through the exits. That's what the ground teams are for. She opens her weapon case using the thumb recognition and assembles Anna Magdalena, her semi-automatic rifle, mounting the tactical scope, loading the magazine. She moves into place, crouching down under the cover of near darkness. The sun will set in less than 20 minutes, which will obscure her position on the roof all the more. She gets herself into position and focuses the scope. She finds the entrance she's looking for, the left field gate. She will wait. It could be 5 minutes. It could be 3 hours. And then she will be called upon to act almost immediately with deadly precision. But this is what she does, and she has never failed. Oh, how she longs to put on her headphones and listen to a piano concerto. But every job is different, and for this one, she needs an advance team giving her prompts in her ear. They could come at any time. So instead of listening to Andrea Bacchetti playing Keyboard Concerto No. 4 at the Teatro Olimpico di Vicenza, she listens to automobile traffic, the cheers of a crowded stadium, blasts of organ music revving up the crowd, and occasional updates from the advance team. She breathes in, breathes out, lets her pulse slow. Keeps her finger close to but free of the trigger. There is no point in impatience. The target will come to her, as always. And as always, she will not miss.
Chapter 23. The man takes the seat next to me without a word, his head down as he moves past me and sits on my immediate left. settling in as if we are strangers who happen to get tickets for adjacent seats. We are, in fact, strangers. I know nothing about him. The unexpected is so common in my job as to be expected, but whenever something comes up, I have a team of advisors to help me analyze it, to collect everything we know and break it down to impose some order amid the chaos. This time, I'm alone and clueless. It can be nothing but a courier delivering information that he may not even understand, impervious to interrogation because he has nothing of value to spill. If that's true, he was misrepresented to me, but it's not as if I can trust the source, the woman known as Nina. He may be an assassin. This whole thing could be a ruse to get me alone and vulnerable. If so, my daughter will be without a living parent, and I will have tainted the office of the president by allowing myself to be suckered into a secret meeting by a simplistic ploy. But I had to take the chance, all because of those two words, Dark Ages. He turns and gets his first look at me up close, at the man he understands to be President Duncan, but who, with a red beard and glasses and baseball cap, doesn't look much like the clean-shaven, suit-wearing commander-in-chief he sees in the media. He gives a slight nod of his head in approval, which I take to be approval not at my disguise per se, but at the fact that I'm wearing a disguise at all. It means I'm playing along. So far, at least. I've agreed to a secret meeting. I've already acknowledged his importance. It's the last thing I wanted to concede, but I had to. As far as I'm concerned, this man could be the most dangerous person in the world right now. I glance around us. No one's sitting on either side of us. Nobody's sitting directly behind us either. "Say the words," I tell the man. He is young. Like his partner Nina, maybe in his early 20s at most. Slim like her, bone structure suggesting Eastern European like hers. He is Caucasian, but with a darker complexion than his partner. Possibly a Mediterranean influence in his heritage, possibly Middle Eastern or African. His face is largely obscured by a long ratty beard and thick, ropey hair that juts out from the baseball cap. His eyes are set deeply, as if bruised. His nose is long and crooked, possibly genetic, possibly the result of having been broken. He's wearing a solid black t-shirt, dark cargo pants, and running shoes. He brought nothing with him in terms of a bag or backpack. He doesn't have a gun. He wouldn't have made it past security. But there are plenty of things that can be weaponized. You can kill someone with a house key, piece of wood, even a ballpoint pen if you insert it with surgical precision into your target's body. In Ranger training, before I shipped out to Iraq, they showed us things, self-defense tactics, opportunistic weapons, that never would have occurred to me. One quick move with a sharp edge into my carotid artery, and I'd bleed out before medical help could arrive. I grab his arm, wrapping completely around his bony limb. "Say the words, now." He is startled by the move. He looks down at my hand, clutching his biceps, then back up at me. Startled, but, I take careful note, not particularly shaken. "Son," I say, reminding myself to keep my facial expression and voice volume in check, "this is not a game. You have no idea who you're messing with. You have no idea how far in over your head you are." I wish my position was as strong as I'm making it out to be. His eyes narrow before he decides to speak.
"What words would you like me to say?" he asks. "Armageddon? Nuclear holocaust?"
The same accent as his partner, but his command of English appears stronger. "Last chance," I say. "You're not going to like what happens next." He breaks eye contact.
"You say these things as if I want something from you, yet it is you who want something from me."
The last point is undeniable. My presence here confirms it. But the converse is also true. I don't know what it is he has to tell me. If it's nothing more than information, he has a price. If it's to communicate a threat, he wants a ransom. He didn't go through all this for nothing. I have something he wants, too. I just don't know what it is. I release the grip on his arm. "You won't make it out of the stadium," I say, rising from my seat.
"Dark Ages," he hisses as if he's uttered a curse word.
On the field, Rendon bounces a high chopper that the shortstop has to catch and throw on the run for the out at first. I sit back down in my seat, take a breath. What do I call you, I ask.
You may call me Augie.
The defiance, the sarcasm is gone, a minor victory for me. His cards are probably better than mine, but he's a kid, and I play poker for a living.
And what should they call you?
He says scarcely above a whisper.
You call me Mr. President.
I put my arm over his chair as if we are old friends or family.
Here's how this is going to work, I say. You're going to tell me how you know those words, and you're going to tell me whatever else you came here to say, and then I'm going to decide what to do. If you and I can work together, if I'm satisfied with our conversation, then this could turn out very well for you, Augie.
I give that a moment to sink in, the light at the end of the tunnel for him. There has to be one in any negotiation.
But if I'm not satisfied, I continue, I'll do whatever is necessary to you, to your girlfriend, to anyone else you care about in this world to protect my country. There's nothing I can't do. There's nothing I won't do.
His mouth curls into a snarl. There's hatred in that expression, no doubt hatred of me and everything I represent, but he's scared, too. He's dealt with me thus far from a distance, using his partner to contact my daughter overseas, using his technology remotely. But now he's here, in person, with the President of the United States. He's past the point of no return.
He leans forward, elbows on knees, in an attempt to move away from me.
Good. He's rattled.
You would like to know how I have come upon Dark Ages, he says, his voice less certain, shaky. You would also like to know why the electricity in the White House continues to, falter?
I don't respond to that outwardly. He's saying he's responsible for the flickering of the lights in the White House. A bluff? I try to remember if Nina saw them flicker while she was there.
It's annoying, one would think, he says. Engaging in important matters of national security and economic policy and political machinations in your Oval Office, while the lights blink on and off as if you live in a shack in a third world country.
He draws a deep breath.
Your technicians have no idea why, do they? Of course they do not.
The confidence in his voice is restored. You have 2 minutes, kid, starting now. If you don't talk to me, you will talk to people who work for me who will not be as friendly. He shakes his head, though it's hard to tell whom he's trying to convince, me or himself.
No, you came alone,
he says, hope in his voice, not conviction.
Did I?
The crowd roars at the sound of a bat hitting a ball, the people around us getting to their feet and cheering, then fading out as the long fly ball veers foul. Augie does not move, still leaning forward, a hard look on his face as he stares into the back of the seat in front of him. 1:30, I say. In the game, the batter takes a called third strike, a slider that paints the corner, and the crowd hoots and hollers its reaction. I check my watch. 1 minute, I say, and then your life is over. Augie leans back to face me again. I keep my eyes on the field, don't accord him the respect of looking in his direction. But eventually I turn to him as if I'm now ready to hear what he has to say. His face is wearing a different expression now, intense and cold. He's holding a handgun in his lap, trained on me.
My life is over?
He asks. Chapter 24. I focus on Augie, not the gun. He has it low in his lap, safe from detection by other ticket holders. I understand now why the seats on either side of us are empty, as are the 4 seats behind and in front of us. Augie bought them all to give us a semblance of privacy. From its boxy shape, I can see it's a Glock, a gun I've never fired, but a 9mm all the same, capable of firing a bullet into me at close range. Once upon a time, I might have stood a chance of disarming him without suffering a fatal shot, but the Rangers was a long time ago. I'm 50 years old, and rusty.
It's not by any means the first time I've had a gun pointed at me. When I was a prisoner of war, an Iraqi prison guard put a pistol to my head every day and pulled the trigger. But this is the first time in a long time, and it's my first time as president. Through the pounding of my pulse, I think it through. He could have already pulled the trigger if his plan was to kill me. He didn't have to wait until I turned to look at him. He wanted me to see the gun. He wanted to alter the dynamic. I hope I'm right about that. He doesn't look like someone with a lot of experience in handling a firearm. I'm a nervous twitch away from a bullet in the ribs. You came here for a reason, I say, so put that gun away and tell me what it is. His lips purse. Perhaps I feel safer this way. I lean forward, lowering my voice. That gun makes you less safe. It makes my people nervous. It makes them want to put a bullet through your head right now while you're sitting there in your seat. He blinks hard in response, his eyes moving about, trying to remain in control. The notion that someone is training a high-powered rifle on you can be unsettling on the nerves. You can't see them, Augie, but believe me, they can see you. There is a risk in what I'm doing. It might not be the wisest move to scare the hell out of a man with his finger on the trigger of a gun pointed at you, but I need him to put that gun away, and I will continue to make him believe that he is not dealing with one man, but with a country, one with overwhelming force, shock and awe capabilities, and resources beyond his comprehension. Nobody wants to hurt you, Augie, but if you pull that trigger, you'll be dead in 2 seconds. No, he says. You came... His voice fades out. What? I came alone? You don't really believe that. You're too smart to believe that. So put the gun away and tell me why I'm here. Otherwise, I walk. The gun moves in his lap. His eyes narrow again. If you walk away, he says, you will not be able to stop what is going to happen. And you'll never get what you want from me, whatever that is. He thinks about that. It's a smart thing for him to do, all things considered, but he wants it to be his idea, not mine. Finally, he nods and hikes up his pants leg, holstering the gun. I release the breath I've been holding. How the hell did you get that gun past the metal detectors? He slides down his pants leg. He looks as relieved as I am. A rudimentary machine, he says, knows only what it is told to know. It has no independent thought. If it is told it sees nothing, then it sees nothing. If it is told to close its eyes, it closes its eyes. Machines do not ask why. I think back to the metal detector as I went through it. There was no X-ray, as there is at an airport. It was just a doorway, and it either beeped or it didn't beep as you passed through it, as the security guard stood by waiting for an audible signal. He jammed it somehow. He disabled it while he passed through. He hacked into the electrical system at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He downed a helicopter in Dubai. And he knew dark ages. Here I am, Augie, I say. You got your meeting. Tell me how you know dark ages. His eyebrows rise. He almost smiles. Obtaining that code word is quite an achievement, and he knows it. Did you hack in somehow, I ask? Or? Now he does smile. It is the ore that concerns you. It concerns you so much that you cannot bring yourself to say the words. I don't argue the point. He's right. Because if I was not able to obtain this remotely, he says, there is no other way I could have obtained it. And you know what this means. If Augie didn't learn Dark Ages through a hack, and it's hard to see how he could have, then he got it from a human being. And the list of human beings with access to Dark Ages is very, very small. It is the reason you agreed to meet me, he says. You clearly understand the significance. I nod. It means there's a traitor in the White House, I say. Chapter 25. The crowd around us breaks into a cheer. An organ plays. The Nationals are running off the field. Someone inches down the row past us towards the aisle. I envy that person, whose greatest concern at this moment is taking a leak or heading to the concession stand to grab some nachos. My phone buzzes. I reach for it in my pocket, then realize a sudden movement could come.